Hey, folks, we found it. The path that's going to get us through this economic turmoil.
Here comes the Shoop Shoop Hula Hoop.
Brilliant entrepreneurs with the ideas and products that are going to bring this economy back to life.
Get a hair whiz.
Pocket fisherman.
The Ginsu can cut a slice of bread so thin you can almost see through it.
The blanket that has sleeves.
Pull the trigger and lock and load.
American dreams, wealth, and prosperity.
Sold separately.
Now available for a limited time only at Woolworth, Woolco, Times Square.
Operators standing by right here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. All right, it's too late to come up with the idea for OxyClean as your American dream. It's Friday, March 13th. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who is on leave with her new baby. Coming up this hour, something you haven't heard about in Afghanistan. A controversial new HBO documentary also shows all the gory details of how animals move from farm to plate. We'll talk to the investigator who got inside the process of processing. All this and more ahead, but first, these headlines.
The economy will dominate President Obama's agenda today. He's meeting with top economic advisor and former Fed chair Paul Volcker. In a speech to business leaders, the president urged America not to be swayed by bipolar market news.
Smidgen of good news, and suddenly everything's doing great. A little bit of bad news. Oh, we're down in the dumps.
Tim Geithner is not down in the dumps. He's among the world financial leaders of the 20th big economies in the UK tomorrow. The G20 meeting sets the table for a larger summit in a few weeks. $2 billion passed. General Motors says it won't need the money it asked for to help get it through March. The carmaker says it's getting expenses under control. Taking money from the TARP? Trying to quit, says GM. Farai?
It's a big day for Asian markets so far. Japan's Nikkei index gained more than 5%. A variety of factors were at work, including good news from U.S. firms and Asian governments supporting stimulus packages. China is among the countries launching stimulus packages. Premier Wen Jiabao says China is ready to build on its more than a $500 billion plan if needed. And Wen's speech also covered the enormous amount of U.S. debt China owns through treasury notes and other government holdings. He's calling on Washington to watch itself and make sure these are safe investments. The U.S. owes more to China than any other country. We'll have a conversation about that in a bit.
America may put troops along the Mexican border to stop spiraling drug violence. Roger Roof of the Homeland Security Department told Congress he hopes it doesn't come to that, though.
We very much do not want to militarize our border. So that is essentially a last resort, but we're planning for it if it becomes necessary.
Vicious fighting between drug smuggling gangs has killed thousands lately. The Dow and S&P both gained yesterday. The Dow moved up more than 3.3%. The S&P more than 4%, ending at 750, where it begins trading today. All this week, we've been talking about the new American dream.
And I believe the American dream is to follow after the footsteps of my grandfather and my father, to grow into somebody who's strong enough to help my country and to help somebody else grow into somebody strong.
Are you like that? Have you created a startup business? Do you have an idea for the next big thing? Way better than the Snuggie or the Pocket Fisherman or the Vegematic. If that's you, call us. We want to hear your idea. If you're an entrepreneur of any kind, tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. That's a part of the American dream, too.
So why trust your family's appearance to a cheap gadget? Get a hair whiz.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora, and today we're asking for the new American dream that you have. Startup business? Idea for the next big thing? Way better than the Snuggie. I know you have it in you. If that's you, call us. And for that matter, if you're an entrepreneur of any kind, tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm noticing this morning that CNBC is actually still on the air after Jim Cramer's
after they were
trashing flamed on The Daily Show. That was such an interesting confrontation of journalism. Here is the fake news show doing the real takedown of the supposedly real financial network.
Yeah, these beefs, though, are getting out of control. It's all—it's almost like the Crips and the Bloods. You've got, you know, beefs between MSNBC, Fox, Rush, everybody. You know, anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, it was a very O'Reilly-esque moment, but well done there on The Daily Show. And the market's, you know, poised to open higher this morning, so maybe it's in reaction. Who knows? We begin this morning in Afghanistan. There are signs all through the administration, and there were signs all during the campaign that Afghanistan was going to be at the center of Barack Obama's foreign policy. About 17,000 new troops are on their way to being deployed there. Last week, President Obama said the U.S. was not winning the conflict. There have been a number of reports from individuals at high levels in the administration talking about how urgent and how central the Afghan conflict is. The whole issue of Afghanistan and South Asia is central to world stability. More casualties there. Instability yesterday in Pakistan. It's a huge issue. And joining us is Mr. Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. He's the author of Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. It's coming out next week. But this morning, Leslie Gelb has an op-ed in the New York Times that has a very provocative view of what should be done in Afghanistan. It perhaps shouldn't be at the center of policy. First of all, Leslie Gelb, thanks so much for being on The Takeaway.
Good day.
You call for a U.S. pullout of Afghanistan. And first of all, lay out your argument, if you could.
Sure. I call for looking at a U.S. pullout very hard because we haven't thought about it very hard. And the basic argument is this. I think it's virtually impossible to think of defeating the Taliban at any reasonable cost in any reasonable time. So the question then becomes, how do you deal with the continuing terrorist threat that might come from Afghanistan and Pakistan, because they're related? And the basic argument of the piece is that we shouldn't do what we don't do well, which is nation building and fight open-ended wars. And we should do what we do pretty well, namely building up people internally, deterring, containing, and forming diplomatic coalitions to deal with the residual problems. We can do that with our power.
Now, you know, a lot of the issues in foreign policy involve assumptions that leaders maybe are hesitant to question. It seems to me that the assumptions that are operative in this policy, both for the Bush administration and now for the Obama administration, is that somehow if we left Afghanistan, if the United States forces and NATO left Afghanistan, that a 9/11 and a buildup of al-Qaeda would inevitably repeat. Is that assumption being questioned or even looked at seriously by the Obama administration?
Yeah, I don't know that it is being seriously questioned, and that it should be, because the Taliban is not the same as al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has been paying the Taliban off for years, and they have been allies, and al-Qaeda did attack us from Afghan soil. So we have to worry about it. But they're not identical organizations. No organization is homogeneous. And we need to explore, as President Obama says he will, differences among them.
Now, the other thing that's interesting.
Can I just add one
point? Oh, yeah, please, go ahead.
Because your question really is a good one. There may well be a continuing terrorist threat from Afghanistan and northwest Pakistan. But the fact of the matter is, we face right now terrorist threats from Pakistan, from Yemen, and from Somalia that are every bit as serious as what we might face in a future Afghanistan where the Taliban partially comes back to power.
And world leaders, and certainly in the Council on Foreign Relations publications, a lot of the analysts say that the world has changed since 9/11. And it seems to me that that argument really goes directly to what you're saying. Because the world has changed, we're not going to be in a situation to be caught unawares by what went on in Afghanistan, one way or another, in the same way that we were, you know, 8-9 years ago.
I hope that's right.
And I mean, I do hope that's right, but it just seems to me that the idea of a terrorist threat building up in a place like Afghanistan again without us being able to observe it is preposterous.
Yeah, I think that's right. And as you know, we did observe it when it was building up before.
Right.
And the Clinton administration even took a missile shot at one of the training camps, just that we didn't take it seriously enough.
Right. All right. Now, a counterargument is published in the New York Times this morning alongside your op-ed from Max Boot, who takes a very, very different approach. And his idea is that we should stay the course in Afghanistan, number one, because it's a very winnable conflict, And number two, because, you know, there are real downsides to leaving Afghanistan unstable. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is I don't think it's winnable, but they make about the best case I've seen for it being winnable. And the real issue is, you know, how long will it take, at what cost? And are there other equally difficult but effective ways of dealing with the problem? If we're going to be in there for another 10 years at ever-increasing levels, where we go up to, say, 100,000 troops, and we might, we're heading in that direction, and where the war spills over very actively on the ground into Pakistan, that's a huge price to pay, and I'm not sure that's the only or best way of dealing with the problem.
The notion of a huge price to pay in Afghanistan is something that is a narrative that we know quite well going back to the 1970s. The Soviet invasion went on for a very long time. The price that the Soviet Union paid was essentially the collapse of its entire system. I don't know if that's in the cards for the U.S., but we're setting ourselves up, it seems, to pay that kind of a price in Afghanistan. Would you agree?
No one since the Mongols has conquered that place. You know, for almost 2,000 years, everyone who's come in from the outside has been opposed by almost all Afghans. It really doesn't work. They don't like foreigners.
This is Farai here. I happen to have a few friends who have been in Afghanistan for different reasons. One was a photojournalist. Another one was there right before the Soviets rolled in. And she felt that there was this essential tension among some of the younger folks, especially, you know, and obviously this is a few decades ago now, that they wanted to reach out to the West. You are saying that it's a very protectionist country, protective, rather, of its cultural and perhaps religious identity. Are there ways to build bridges that make sense from a cultural perspective or at least a non-military perspective?
Yeah, and, you know, we're trying to do some of that now, but it's not easy. We essentially have a military presence there, and in order to deal with the security problem, inevitably we end up killing some Afghan civilians, which only aggravates the problem. You know, sure, there are a lot of Afghans that like America and like what we stand for, and particularly women, you know, who want to have a chance to get back to where they were going in the 60s in that country. Look to us as a protector, which makes the decision on what we do all the harder.
Well, Leslie Gelb, then let me ask you a couple of hard questions. David Petraeus tactically, triumphed in Afghanistan, certainly, even if you look sort of politically, what the reaction to the surge was in Afghanistan. Is it possible that Afghanistan will be Petraeus's strategic downfall? And some have said that Pakistan will be Barack Obama's Vietnam. Evaluate those two propositions.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what they ought to be thinking about for sure. I wish them both well. I hope that whatever course they choose, it works. But I'm really worried that they've set the sights too high on eliminating a threat, or as President Obama says, to eliminate the potential for terrorist attacks from Afghan soil. That means military victory, in effect, and it's just beyond them. Are they worried about getting into their own quagmire, their own Vietnam, their own Iraq? Yes, they are. I think General Petraeus is confident he can do the same kinds of things in Afghanistan he did in Iraq. But let me remind you of this. David Petraeus is the first to tell everybody that even though the security situation in Iraq has improved immensely, that the situation there is still fragile and vulnerable, and it could turn around and go the other way again very quickly.
And these are all questions that are going to be discussed at the National Security Council today. And whether there's a debate going on about a pullout in Afghanistan, that remains to be seen. To my guest, Leslie Gelb, is the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has an op-ed in today's New York Times arguing for thinking about a pullout in Afghanistan. Thank you, Leslie Gelb.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Looking at slices of the new American dream. That's what we've been doing all week here on The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farai Jadeja.
Hello.
Good morning, Farai. So if you've created a startup business, we think the American dream is all about you.
Blankets are okay, but they can slip and slide. And when you need to reach for something, your hands are trapped inside. Now, there's the Snuggie, the blanket that has sleeves. The Snuggie keeps you totally warm.
Sure, that wasn't your idea, but you wish it was, don't you? If you had such an idea and want to start a business and think that that's your key to the American dream, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Lucy writes on our website, I've created a learn-to-read system for children experiencing difficulty reading. My dream is to have the money to develop games, tools, and have the financial support to sell to the public. It would be a huge success, and I'd be able to have financial independence. Wish me the best. So please, get in touch with us at mytakeitotakeaway.org. Farai?
And speaking of children, this is not the kind of farm you take your kids to on a field trip.
After 2 to 3 weeks of having those piglets, you know, they're ready to be weaned from their mothers, we grab them, then we throw them off into this bin. The way to do it, that they decided, was to grab them by their legs or their ears sometimes and just throw them. You can hear them screaming. They hit the crate and bounce off the sides of it, sometimes hit the floor.
That's the voice of a man we can only call Pete. He is an activist and investigator who works undercover at factory farms, hoping to document abuse. He went undercover at a farm in Ohio, and the resulting footage can be seen on the new HBO documentary, Death on a Factory Farm, airing on Monday night. So Pete's here in studio with us. We're just using that name because you do go undercover. And what does it mean for you to go undercover? You go undercover as a worker?
Right. What I do is I go into primarily now factory farms and slaughterhouses, and I get a job where I will have the most access to the animals, and then I just observe the conditions that they're in and what the other workers do with them.
You know, the title of your film is Death on a Factory Farm. I mean, I know I'm going to get emails for even asking this question, but I mean, you know, the farm does produce food. The expectation of death on a farm is certainly not something that would come as a surprise to anyone, right?
Oh, no. I mean, and that's a very, very good question. Most states, in fact, every state that I know of has exemptions for state cruelty laws for animals in agriculture, specifically because they realize that when you're dealing with a large quantity of animals, there's going to be a certain degree of abuse, and that just needs to be tolerated because how else are you going to get these animals out to market? And that is what we try to expose in the animal rights movement, is to show people what that abuse is and what the cost of having animal products really is.
So give me an example. You know, we heard there about piglets being slung through a, you know, a chute. But what was the thing that you found most personally I'll back into you being a vegan, I believe. But
right.
What did you find most personally disturbing that you witnessed and also that you had to do in order to keep your job?
I would say the worst was that at one point there were crippled sows. They were down sows. So these sows could not walk on their own. They had broken legs or they may have had a broken back. More than one I could see had a broken leg, and it was large and swollen and obviously had an infection. And we would drag them out with catch poles, these metal loops around their legs, including the broken legs. And we would drag them about 200 feet and drop them off a 4-foot ledge. And then they were piled on each other, and then they were hanged with chains wrapped around their necks, and a front loader would raise up and then hang them to death. And it would take about 4 to 5 minutes for each of them to die. So,
That's a long time. That's not something to hear about with your bacon, I guess.
No. And so the thing is that this case was not just – I mean, really at every factory farm I've worked at, I've seen something I believe is not just a normal standard practice, but is actually illegal animal cruelty. But it's very difficult to get the local sheriff or the local DA to act on it because this is a good old boy business and, you know, they know each other. But in this case, we really, really felt that we had hit the nail on the head in showing with obtaining that footage that there's going to be a conviction for animal cruelty on this. And in this case, they actually got away with doing that. They were not convicted of cruelty on that count.
because it was considered just part of doing business.
Right. What happened was that a vet came in from another state who had not seen the footage, who had not spoken to the defendants, who had not been to the farm, and said that he did not believe that that was cruelty to animals.
And a judge ruled that it wasn't.
Right. The judge decided that he had two vets, one which sided with the prosecution, one which sided with the defense, and that there were options in the state of Ohio for euthanizing animals. But because they were listed as options, and that specific word was used, he felt certainly there's other options that could be used, and why not asphyxiation? And so if he has a vet who comes in from the state of Iowa and says he doesn't think it's cruel, the judge just decided, well, I'll just let this one go.
Now, you personally are a vegan.
Right.
Which means that you don't eat meat, but you also don't eat eggs and dairy and animal-derived products, correct?
Right.
Some people who I know who are vegans or vegetarians believe that there are humane ways of being an omnivore. Like, think of Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, where you
right.
really think through, what does it mean to eat meat? Other people say, absolutely no way, never eat meat. There's no excuse. Who are you?
Personally, I'm a person where I wear non-leather boots. I don't use products tested on animals. I go the full 9 yards on that. And for me, it's easier for me to make that decision because I know firsthand what it is these animals go through. And I've had to do it myself and always against my will. I never want to, but I have to maintain my cover and to show what happens there. And so
when you say I have to do it myself, do you mean actually killing animals?
I have had to kill animals when I've been ordered to do so by a supervisor. I've let animals be neglected to death because I was not told to take care of them and no one else would. And I would show on a daily basis how, including dogs, would just waste away. And dogs are closer to my heart than anything else, and that's the hardest to see. But I would certainly never do that to an animal for any convenience or medicine or clothing or food.
Wow, Pete. That's a lot to think. A lot to think about.
Yeah, a lot of courage. There.
Huge. And you know, the new documentary on HBO is called "Death on a Family Farm." It airs on Monday night. Quite literally, some food for thought.
It should be called "Vegan in the Slaughterhouse."
Yes.
Great name.
Femi Okeh with the news.
Thank you very much, Fry. The time is just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. The NAACP is taking aim at subprime lenders. Today is adding Wells Fargo and HSBC to the list of targets for legal action. They accuse the banks of forcing black homebuyers into risky subprime mortgages. The civil rights group says that whites with identical qualifications got better rates, and there are already lawsuits pending against a dozen other subprime lenders. Doctors Without Borders says that 35 of its foreign staff are now leaving Darfur. Three medical workers from the organization were kidnapped on Wednesday. The Sudanese government blames bandits for the abduction and says they are demanding a ransom. Tax havens are bleeding developing nations dry. That's according to a new report from an international aid agency. Oxfam says that citizens of poor countries use offshore shelters to dodge some $120 billion in taxes each year. And the group wants Western leaders to shut down the tax havens. That's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Billy Mays here, breaking your back, pounding, super strong, super, super strong. Now that's the strength of Billy Mays guaranteed. Super strong.
This is how we get our exercise here in the studio. We're just pump, 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 pump it up. Talking about the new American dream.
My name is Kara from Oklahoma City, and my American dream was finding a way to be independent after graduation.
Today we're talking about business. If you have created a startup business or have a dream of one day starting your own little piece of paradise, call us, write us, email us. We want to know what your new American dream is for your small business, like this man.
Why don't I just make a computer with no big old metal front panel? I have to drill all these holes in. Why do that? Why don't I just type in what I want, type the data straight into memory, have a little program?
You know, it just seemed so ridiculous at the time. But Steven Wozniak, co-inventor of the Apple Mac. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
And now he's on Dancing with the Stars. So,
yes.
Rocket to success.
There. On Twitter, Guy Kawasaki texted, geek down, because apparently he hurt his foot.
Yeah, well. You can't do everything. Okay? You can just invent the Apple. That's not it. All right, in this economy, more seriously, when China talks, the world listens. China's Prime Minister Wen Jiabao says confidence is worth more than gold these days. But confident is not how he's feeling about the U.S. Treasury Department. He said today that he's worried about the safety of the Treasury's large holdings and other debt. The Chinese Treasury holds an enormous amount of U.S. debt. Nearly half of China's $2 trillion in currency reserves are invested in U.S. Treasury bonds. For more, we spoke with the BBC correspondent James Reynolds in Beijing earlier this morning. And when we spoke, I asked James what he thought was going on behind Wen Jiabao's careful remarks.
I think it was a very carefully calibrated decision to use the words that he did. And John, I want to explain to you a little bit about the context. He was not surprised by the question he was asked, because the Chinese officials had been calling around news agencies in the past few weeks saying, would you like to ask a question? The Wall Street Journal was one of those approached by the Chinese foreign ministry. In other words, China knew that it was going to be asked something about U.S. Treasury bonds. And he used the words, I'm a little bit worried. I do have worries about U.S. Treasury bonds. That's gone a little bit beyond what he's said before. That's a slight inching up, a slight recalibration of China's worry. Beforehand, he said we must always diversify our investments. Now, for the first time, he said he's a little bit worried.
Now, you know, here China has two missions. One, it's to reassure the markets and to really clarify what is a fairly devilish relationship here. I mean, China relies on U.S. Purchases to fuel its demand in its own economy, as well as the U.S. relies on China to finance all of the problems that we have over here. But China also needs to project its, in some sense, its supremacy, its emergence as an economic power here. So they have to project that they're kind of on top, but also moving very, very carefully. Do you think they were successful?
Perhaps, certainly the reaction of the markets today in this very short term tends to suggest that they were successful. But this relationship, this fascinating relationship between China and the United States, may become the defining story of the next few years. You'll know, of course, this week the two countries have been arguing about military issues. There was a dispute in the South China Sea, the two countries' worst military confrontation for 8 years. And now there's a realization they're trapped together. The fate of China relies on decisions which will be made by consumers where you are in the United States. If people in America stop buying things made in China, people in China get unemployed.
So in the center ring, China and the United States. The rest of the world is in the bleachers watching?
To some extent. Look, some historians have said, look, forget other countries. There's only one country. There's Chi-America. There's China and America. The two countries almost coexist to such an extent that the fate of one is the fate of the other. Clearly, there are other trading partners which China values, in particular its trading partners around Asia, Japan, its growing relationship with India. The presidents and prime ministers of China are always nipping off to Africa to get more mineral resources. But there's one big relationship, and that's the relationship with the United States.
James, when you take a look at this relationship, is there a possibility that China could try to withdraw the assets that it has in the U.S.? Is there ever going to be a moment where China says, you know what, all of this borrowing, I mean, this lending that we've done to the borrower nation of America has got to stop, and we're going to have to pull out of this relationship?
Farah, we've been listening to the winds and the whispers on this topic for some time. We aren't hearing anything about that at the moment? Any type of rumor which would lead us to suggest that China's going to say, you know what, we'll take our $800 billion or so, and thank you very much, we'll invest it somewhere safer. It is important to know, though, that Wen Jiabao's comments today were about as far as China has gone in saying that it's worried. But China hasn't yet taken the next step. It hasn't said, we're worried and we're thinking about going elsewhere. At the moment, China's simply saying, we're worried, full stop, please reassure us. In other words, China's saying, next step, United States.
But part of the insurance policy here is that there's really no alternative. I mean, if the euro was doing much better, that would be a whole different context for Wen Jiabao's remarks. And partly, it seems like he wants to project a sense of leadership and that he's still holding cards. What do you give us your assessment of his personality, his style of leadership?
He's probably the most fascinating politician in China, I'd say, by a long distance. He is one of the main leaders of the Communist Party. He's actually number three in the hierarchy. But he is, by some distance, the most popular politician in China because he's seen as incredibly frugal. There were huge cheers for him the other year when it was worked out. He was wearing the same rather tatty overcoat for the last 10 years. He spends a lot of holidays with Chinese peasants. He's seen as an ally of poor people. And really, in terms of public image in China, he has an image which perhaps is only rivaled by President Obama in America.
Amazing. That was BBC correspondent James Reynolds in Beijing. In that interview conducted earlier this morning, James gave us a fascinating profile of China's Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, who says he's concerned about the holdings of American debt in the Chinese treasury. Concerned? What beyond that? We don't know. Femi Okeh's here with the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. We're just getting some news in the last few minutes about the U.S. trade deficit. It fell in January to the lowest level in 6 years as a deepening recession has cut demands for imported goods. President Obama is extending sanctions against Iran for another year. He says Iran is still a threat to the United States. The sanctions prohibit American companies from investing in the country, and the sanctions were imposed by President Clinton. That was back in 1995 over Iran's nuclear program and alleged support for terrorism. Two out of three people who ask the FBI for their records can't get them. That's according to a private study. It says the FBI avoids giving up information under the Freedom of Information Act by using an outdated search system. The FBI's index includes a wide variety of information, including the names of individuals, organizations, companies, and publications. Now, it's just a matter of time before the tallest building in the United States will no longer be the Sears Tower. Now, nobody is building one taller, but Chicago's famous Sears Tower will be renamed the Willis Tower later on this year. And it's all because of the international insurance broker Willis Group moving into the building, and they have naming rights along with their lease. Now, the mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley, told reporters that he's not upset about the name change.
They own the building, they should name it, sure. But Sears has moved a long time ago. No, it's a building. They bought the building. And they have a right to. They're putting money into it. They're going to announce great plans for it.
That's Chicago's Mayor Richard Daley about the Sears Tower.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Well, maybe you think all this week on The Takeaway, we've been obsessed. But really, you have been, too, with the idea of the American dream. And it all started out with this call from Leah Clark.
My name's Leah Clark, and I'm from Rochester, Michigan. And I just think that people are going to start to see through this American dream. That owning a house is great, but you're sacrificing your hobbies, seeing the world, maybe things that make you feel really alive that you can spend your money on for a house. A lot of my friends, I'm in my mid-20s, and a lot of my friends are spending all of their money on their house, and they feel trapped. And I think that the younger generation is going to start to see through this.
Leah's message started a whole week of conversations. We learned from Vanity Fair writer David Camp where the idea of an American dream even came from in the first place. And so many of you who wrote and called us to tell us what your new American dream is had all kinds of interesting things to say. What is the new American dream? Well, some of you thought it was not very pretty.
Hi, this is Eric from New Jersey. And I think that the new American dream is simply surviving what we're about to get into.
you're headed into a new depression.
Or maybe it's something of a mirage.
We come from Cuba because my grandmother wants us to be here. In Cuba, we have free universidad and free medicine. Here in the United States, the American dream is a nice picture, but not for real.
Some of you said simplify, simplify, simplify.
Hey, this is Michelle from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I would say that my idea of the American dream is raising happy, healthy kids and having some time to have dinner with my husband every once in a while.
Or how about just freedom from work?
Seems that the American dream nowadays is winning something like American Idol or something like that. Never having to work after not having ever worked.
My dream is to do nothing. I am 24 and I am sick of bills and a job ruining a life that I should be spending having fun and enjoying my family. So, yeah, nothing.
A lot of you told us that as the economy changes, so does your idea of the American dream, that that's been pretty painful.
I think that the American dream these days, just being able to afford retirement. I'm watching the retirement going down the tubes, and that's going to make us work a lot longer in order to be able to retire.
But in the dozens and dozens of people who did call 877-8-MY-TAKE and give us their stories, there was a narrative of hope.
Hi, this is Alan from Holtsville. I'm an immigrant. The American dream for me still means possibilities. America is still a place where people could change their minds. You can't do that everywhere.
This is Don from Providence, Rhode Island. Call me a high school English teacher. I am. But there's no better statement of the American dream still than the Great Gatsby. It may be tawdry, but you could be whatever you want to be and make yourself whatever you want to make yourself.
So updating Gatsby, well, Johnny Sue wrote that her 12-year-old daughter is going to try. I had this conversation with my daughter the other night. She said the dream didn't exist. I told her the American dream is what you make it to be. To me, it meant freedom, freedom to work at a job you wanted. The dream is what you make it. And what makes it American is the freedom to pursue it. Tell us your American dream at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora, who is out on maternity leave all this week. We have been talking about the new American dream, and we want to hear from you if you've done anything entrepreneurial, started a business, pitched an invention, maybe you think you should start the new big thing. Call us, email us, tell us your version of the American dream. Listener Dominic DePinto says owning your own business still has a few perks. He writes, remember when you own your own business, you are the last one to be laid off. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake at thetakeaway.org. Now, Femi, okay, take it away with the headlines.
Thank you very much, Farai. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street doesn't get going until next hour, but the European markets are up. That follows huge gains for Asian indices. Japan's Nikkei leaped more than 5% following positive news about Asian stimulus packages and strong performances by major companies. Global finance ministers are streaming into the UK to figure out how to keep the markets moving in the upwards direction. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is among the G20 leaders attending the Saturday meeting. And today, the president meets with Paul Volcker. The former Fed chair is a top economic advisor. He will brief the president on how the $787 billion stimulus package is doing. And this follows a Thursday packed with White House moves on the economy. And yesterday, the president talked stimulus with state leaders and met with business leaders. That's a look at top stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi. Well, the American dream is a flexible thing. When the American dream came into full bloom in the 1950s, black folks were out of sight and out of mind. Never mind, we were actually busy inventing the blues and rock and roll. There was a practice called redlining, where black neighborhoods were denied services like banking and equal housing. It was a vision of two Americas that emboldened the civil rights movement. In other words, the American dream then was for some, but not for all. Well, how's it going today? To help us answer, we're joined by Ta-Nehisi Coates, a contributing editor and a blogger for The Atlantic, and author of The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and An Unlikely Road to Manhood. Before we get to the big questions, what's your American dream?
Wow. What's my American dream?
Mm-hmm.
That my son will go to school and not embarrass me on a daily basis. I wake up in the morning thinking about that.
I think people in China, India, yeah. Africa all have that dream,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just pray that the boy doesn't embarrass me.
A father's dream.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And you know what? That was my dad's dream also. So, you know, we have a sort of generational thing. In all seriousness, it's actually, I think, not that different than what the stereotypical American dream is, and that is that the belief that, or the hope that all people, you know, no matter what their circumstances, will have a right to compete in the field that they're choosing.
What do you think the situation, well, maybe a way to talk about the situation that black folks have faced vis-a-vis the American dream is to talk about your father, who you paint a vivid portrait of in your memoir. How do you think your father related to the concept of the American dream? Someone who went on to become a pioneering publisher of black knowledge that nobody else was keeping track of.
Initially, I noticed to be true, much like anybody else related to the American dream, my dad went into the Vietnam War, went into the Army. Like so many people before him went into the Army, he wanted to be John Wayne. I mean, he was a black kid who grew up in West Philadelphia in the 1940s and 50s, but had the same visions of America and dreams of America that anybody else, you know, black, white, whatever, would have. Became very radicalized in the Army and by the Vietnam War to some extent, and then later coming out and into the 60s and the things that were going on and you know, we all know what that was.
So he was kind of like the Lawrence Fishburne character in Apocalypse Now.
Or more like the Lawrence Fishburne character in Boys
yeah.
in the Hood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Much more like that.
Yeah.
For the good and for the bad. That's just me thinking about him as a father. But yeah, very much I think radicalized by the Vietnam War and by the 60s, and came out, I think, like a lot of black folks, even today, very skeptical or with a sort of jaundiced eye of the American dream. It's interesting, if I just may add this. I keep thinking about Michelle Obama and that pride remark that she took so much flack for.
That she finally felt proud of America.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing.
Right, right. And in many ways of looking at that.
For the first time.
Right. And in many ways of looking at that, and I don't offer this so much as an interpretation of what she meant, but as just a commentary on African Americans and patriotism, because that's always an issue. People just have to remember the history of what African Americans have been through. The most poignant thing that I think about is the veterans who went to war during World War I in segregated armies for a segregated country, came home to the South and were often, or I shouldn't say often, at times lynched in their uniforms. When you have those sorts of experiences, you will probably have a different perspective on what the American dream is and means.
But some of the statistics that are out there now about the American dream and a sense of optimism, that despite that history, mm-hmm. African Americans report having a much greater sense of optimism here in this Obama era than most of the rest of the economy faced with all of this downturn, that there's a kind of a dual perspective of
right.
skepticism, but also a sense of the future is before us.
Right. And you know, it's probably at a high point now with Obama's election, but that's always been true. I mean, the one thing you say about Martin Luther King, even going back to Frederick Douglass, there was always this option of leaving America and going, you know, to Africa. African Americans always believed in the Declaration of Independence, in the Constitution, maybe more than the Constitution and Declaration of Independence believed in them. Martin Luther King had great faith in this country and in what it could be. There was never any doubt about where the best place was for African Americans. So there was never really any doubt that there were opportunities here to compete. Even, and this shocks a guy like me, but that's always been true for African Americans, going back to Booker T. Washington.
Well, Ta-Nehisi, at this point, and some of these tensions come up in your memoir, you have black people who live almost exclusively around non-black people, black people who live in mixed communities and workplaces, black people who live almost exclusively with black people. Where does the best future for black Americans lie in following a path that allows us to sort of circle the wagons when times are tough in the black community and try to remain a very cohesive group, or to try to reach out and you know, disseminate our wisdom to other parts? I mean, is that part of the question that the black community is facing right now?
You know, I don't know. I do know this, and that is that the case for separatism was never particularly strong in the black community. I mean, we have our nationalist impulses like anybody else, but we made a choice to decide to become a part of America. That's where the future is. I don't know how long that process is going to take,
right,
but I think that's where it's going.
And the struggle itself is etching the American dream on this sort of stone edifice of history in some sense. The struggles that you talk about, even the exclusion, is a more persuasive statement of the American dream than a lot of the stuff we've heard this week.
Well, yeah. No. And certainly so. And I just think retaining that spirit of optimism through all of that. And that's one of the unreported things about African Americans.
If you gave me one sentence on how you think you are doing at achieving your American dream, be it having your son not embarrass you, how well are you doing?
Depends on the day.
And depends on the day. Yeah, that is a good answer, and it's true for so many of us. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a contributing editor and blogger for The Atlantic and author of The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and An Unlikely Road to Manhood.
I have another question for him, and you can see it actually on the web. Go to our website for the video of that interview. And one more question. We set him down. All this week we've been talking about the new American dream.
I'm 69 years old. I'm about to change careers or retire from my current profession. I've lived the American dream. I've spent the past 40 years doing work that I absolutely adore.
What's your next mountain to climb? Tell us a story of the business, enterprise, or invention you've pitched. We want to hear about it. Our listener Carolyn in Salt Lake City writes, "The problem underlying this economic disaster is that growth is dependent upon us continuing to buy stupid widgets we don't need. We built our wealth on a house of cards, and now it is falling apart. To move forward, this economy needs a new paradigm. The next big thing is the problem, not the solution." Tell us your view of the American dream at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Listen to that great interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. And here's your takeaway.
Some historians have said, look, forget other countries. There's only one country. There's Chimerica. There's China and America. The two countries almost coexist to such an extent that the fate of one is the fate of the other.
Chimerica. That's distinct from Cramerica.
It reminds me of, you know, chimerical, the word that means a fantasy.
Indeed.
So Chimerica, the fantasy of living the dream?
Certainly. And, you know, the relationship of the U.S. and China is what James Reynolds, BBC correspondent in Beijing, was talking about. They're also a good candidate for a podcast.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
We go now to 23-year-old Miko Mercer. Miko?
Hi.
So you emailed us the other day that you were having some trouble coming up with your own American dream. Can I try some American dreams out on you?
Sure.
Okay. Miko's dream is to be president of the United States.
No, I don't think so.
Really? How about start a band and have a hit record?
No.
Global martial arts champion?
Definitely don't have the skill for that.
Olympic pole vaulter?
Oh, no.
How about start a company that makes you richer than God?
Oh, definitely not.
A company that ends world hunger?
No.
Hitchhike across the country and fall in love. How about that?
Come on, not really.
All right, well, Mika, you say you were raised to believe you could do anything to achieve your dreams no matter what they were. What's the problem here?
Well, I just feel like, you know, there's so many possibilities out there. We really don't know what we want yet. So just finding it out, you know, across the course of life is really my best answer.
So you gotta figure out your dream. That is a problem. Well, I don't know what
right.
we can do for you except introduce you to about a million people who might have some suggestions. What do you say?
Sure. That sounds great.
Mika Mercer, meet America. America, Mika. 1 million American dreams coming right up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Let's help out Mika, will you? It's Friday, March 13th. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I am Farai Chidea, and for Adora Udoji, who is on leave with her new baby. Coming up this hour, you'll join a conversation with two top CEOs for a high-level take on the economy. Plus, a new memoir takes a fresh and surprising look at the Black experience. You'll meet the author in a moment. This and more ahead, but first, the headlines.
A couple of quick economic stories leading today. Plenty of economic movement here and abroad. Asian markets closed way up. Japan's Nikkei index grew more than 5%. Wall Street opens, looks positively. In about 30 minutes, we're looking at the futures trading. And there's more trade data out in the last hour. U.S. trade deficit at its lowest level in 6 years.
Well, the economy is going to dominate President Obama's agenda today. He is meeting with top economic advisor and former Fed chair Paul Volcker. He'll brief the president on how the stimulus package is going so far. And Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is one of the many world leaders flying to the UK for a weekend meeting. It's called the G20 Summit. Financial ministers will set the table for a larger April summit that President Obama will attend.
Over in Pakistan, missile strikes, protests, and clashes are happening across that country. 20 dead in the country's wild northwest province as U.S. drones repeatedly attacked militant strongholds.
And demonstrators are clashing with police across the country. Lawyers and opposition leaders want judges sacked by the former leader to get their job back. But the government is trying to thwart the marchers with roadblocks and riot gear. Imran Chaudhry is one of the lawyers protesting. He's optimistic.
The roads are being blocked. Different methods of arrests, detentions, they are in process. I am sure they are going to fail and we are going to succeed.
Today is the day two of 4 days of planned protest.
Tense situation. The Dow and S&P gained yesterday. The S&P begins at 750. If you've created a startup business, if you're an entrepreneur, the American dream is about you. If that's your idea, give us a call. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You have an idea. Give it to us. Pitch it.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I have a dream.
What's happening to us?
The American dream.
A better way of life.
The great American
dream.
Well, tell me you don't know what that is. Okay, well, it's actually quite all right if you don't.
My piece of the American dream.
What everybody wants as they start out.
Securing your portion of the American dream.
In my American dream, the people do make a difference.
Good morning, everyone. You might say my American dream is hosting this program, The Takeaway, with my co-host, Farai Chidea.
Du jour, exactly.
She's in for Adora Udoji. All this week, we've been talking about the new American dream. If you've done anything entrepreneurial, what's the next big thing? Call us. Lucy Aponte contacted us at our website. She's an artist and a nurse in the Bronx involved in all of this. Lucy, American dream, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for weighing in. We'll hear your idea in a second. Also, Alex Andon is on the line from San Francisco. Alex, good morning.
Good morning.
And I want both of you to get your ideas ready and pitch them to Farai and myself, and also to Stephen Key, who's a co-founder of InventRight, a company dedicated to educating inventors about selling their ideas. And Stephen knows from what he speaks. He helped launch Teddy Ruxpin. Stephen, you're the Teddy Ruxpin dude?
Well, I'm one of the guys that helped. There's a team of us, John.
Well, the control room, which all of whom grew up on Teddy Ruxpin, are in tears right now.
Well, it was the late 80s, so it really dates me, but thank you.
That's fine. All right. So, Alex and Lucy, pitch your ideas. Lucy, you begin.
Okay. I created a learn-to-read system to teach children how to read in starting in the toddler ages. And then I later modified it for children with learning disabilities when I was a foster mother, and had great success, and have tutored children in schools. And teachers are always looking and saying, what are you doing? How are you getting that done? And I'm surprised and amazed at the success. I know it's an incredible system that I've created. I just need the attention and the money for this.
And you'd like to start a business?
Yes, absolutely.
Selling teaching materials to whom?
Well, to the public, to children, to schools, just in general, to nationwide, worldwide.
Stephen Key, what do you make of this idea?
Well, I think it's fantastic. I think there's two ways you can do this, Lucy. Mm-hmm. You could start a business like you want to do. You can also try to license that idea to a company that has, I would say, the distribution, and can give you the help to bring your dreams to life.
So, Lucy Aponte, you're already working, right?
Yes, I'm a nurse.
You're a nurse at a homeless shelter in the Bronx, right?
Yes, I am, and I use it at the shelter, teaching the mothers how they can teach their children to read, and I've started a very early literacy program there for the shelter.
But, Lucy, you know, you've got a job. You're doing fine. Why don't you just stay where you are?
Well, because someday I'm going to have to leave that. I won't be able to continue that. And I have, a home, and my dream is to be financially independent, completely, and stable.
Alex and Don, pitch your idea to Farai.
Okay, basically, jellyfish are going to be the next big thing in fish tanks, is my theory. About 20 years ago, right down the road from me at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, some scientists had figured out how to keep jellyfish in captivity. And they'd been studying them, and they thought, oh, let's throw a few up in an exhibit, see what happens. And people absolutely loved them. It was possibly their most successful exhibit ever. And since then, now you can't find a public aquarium anywhere without a jellyfish exhibit. Yet, you can't really get a jellyfish for your home or office or whatever. So I'm letting people bring that beauty that they love at the public aquariums with the jellyfish exhibits, letting people bring that home to their homes and offices and or whatever.
So jellyfish, from what I have seen, are in salt water. I don't know if there's freshwater jellyfish, but I've heard saltwater tanks are really hard to manage. So what are you going to bring to the table that would allow me to enjoy the beautiful nature of these aquatic creatures without killing them?
Well, it's true they are salt water, but they're really very easy to keep to take care of. I'd say they're easier than a regular goldfish bowl. I mean, we're working right now on a desktop tank that's going to be just like a goldfish bowl, except with jellyfish, and it's incredibly easy to take care of. Just feed once a day, clean the tank every few days, and change the filter every 2 weeks or so.
Stephen Key, what do you think?
Wow, sounds like a fascinating idea. I think you're right that jellyfishes are pretty popular at there in Monterey. I think you're going to have some issues that you just need to do your homework first. Check with some of the places that sell fishes at aquariums and see if they're interested in this type of idea, and then maybe they can help you as well.
Do you think, Stephen, that this is an economic commentary of one kind? Fish tanks were really popular during the economic upturn, but I think there were a lot of sort of, piranha in those fish tanks. jellyfish for this decade? What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's people are looking for different types of entertainment, and I think they're staying home more, and I think this is something that could be something I think you need to look at. But you need to do your homework first before you just jump in on any idea that you have.
I want to jump in for Lucy. I was reading USA Today this week, and they mentioned something called WeBook, WeBook.com, that allows you to essentially test market your book to a group of people and see if there's any audience for it. I'm not advocating that you do this because I don't know anything about it except that I read about it. But it seems to me that if you do some research, you might find places that really are trying to deal with the question of first-time authors who don't have a track record.
Oh, I definitely will try that. Is that We as W-E?
Yep,
We Books.
Singular.
You know what we've learned around here is that Farai Chidea is like the networker extraordinaire. So you write down whatever it is that she said. So let's turn you guys into a little focus group for each other's idea. Alex, what do you think of the reading materials that Lucy is talking about? Do you think that might have an application out where you are?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it really would be very useful out here.
Now, Lucy, here in New York, there's lots of talk about, you know, green, you know, get in touch with the environment. Do you think that might be a motivation for people to get jellyfish in their fish tanks?
Yes, absolutely. I'm into green living as well.
All right. Well, those are two interesting responses to two interesting ideas. Alex, good luck.
Thank you.
And Lucy Aponte, good luck, and I hope you're not late for work talking to us.
No, I'm not.
And if anybody has more interest or wants to leave a comment on either of these ideas, please do it at our website, mytakeatthetakeaway.org, or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stephen Key, generally speaking, this trajectory to have an idea and to become financially independent as a component of the American dream, is it powerful, or is it more like a kid wanting to be in the NBA because he has a decent hook shot on the playground?
No, John, you'd be surprised. You know, anybody with an idea, if they take the right steps, and what I mean by the right steps is you need to get a little protection, which is easy to do and you can do it yourself. But now is the perfect time for inventors or anybody with an idea to get those ideas out. There's thousands of companies today are looking for ideas. So it's a perfect time, and it's not just a dream. You can do it, but you have to realize you have to come up with a lot of ideas, and you need to be very persistent, and you need some good information, and you can bring those ideas to market.
Now, when do you know that you've just got to wrap it up, that it's just not good? What's the signal that it's over?
Well, I think the best thing to do, you know, what people used to do is that they would file a patent real quickly, and I don't want people to do that because that's very expensive. And they used to build a prototype. What you can do today is put together a sell sheet. And basically, that's just a one page that has a benefit statement and a picture of your idea. But you want to, first of all, get a little bit of protection, but then you want to show it to industry experts. Get their advice. See if there's interest first. And if you show it around and you show it to five or six companies and you get no interest, then maybe you need to move on, come up with another idea.
Well, you know, Farai's question is a great one because there's nobody who has the magic expertise on this question of when are you through? I mean, Enron couldn't figure it out. Madoff didn't know it, right? I mean, so many people on Wall Street, Buffett didn't know it. So you know, you should feel confident that if your instincts are worthwhile, go ahead and pursue them. And you think a recession is a good time for this?
No, absolutely. In fact, there's some very hot categories. If you have a kitchen idea or some type of gadget for the kitchen that's under $15, that there's companies. We have a directory at InventRight.com where we list over 250 companies. There's companies there that if you have that kitchen idea, they're looking for it. That because people are staying home.
A sequel to the Ginzu knife. Stephen Key, co-founder of InventRight, a company dedicated to educating inventors about selling their ideas in this recession. Thanks to Stephen, and thanks to all of you entrepreneurs. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Is that the path out of this recession?
Heck, good idea.
Good idea is part of the American dream.
But caveat emptor.
Indeed.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji, who is with her new daughter. All this week, we've been talking about the new American dream. Have you created a startup business? Do you have a dream of one day starting one? Maybe an idea for some wacky thing, bigger than a Snuggie, bigger than the Ginsu knife.
The Ginsu can cut a slice of bread so thin you can almost see through it.
Call us, write us, email us. We want to know what your new American dream is for your small business. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So, Fry, who would want to read a memoir of someone who grew up in the privileged California community of Palos Verdes, a suburban story? Yeah. I mean, who would want to read that? Everyone will want to read The Black Girl Next Door from our next guest. The author, Jennifer Bazile, joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. First of all, Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
You know, this is a story that I want to just frame a little bit. There were Supreme Court decisions in the 1950s. Of course, the history of civil rights goes way, way back in America, but if we start in the 60s with the Supreme Court decisions, the congressional acts that created the civil rights laws and the voting rights laws, then parents and families made decisions in the 60s and 70s to actually live in an integrated way, and parents moved into neighborhoods all around the United States. But the implications of integration were lived by young girls like you on the streets of places like Palos Verdes, where you are the one black person in the neighborhood, right?
That's right.
And through your eyes, what was that like? And I'm drawn to the fight on the playground that really is a scene that I still get chills just thinking back to reading. I've read it twice or three times now.
Well, thank you so much. You know, here's the thing. When we think about history, we often think about the big ceremonial events, the rituals, the court decisions, the pictures that we saw on the evening news. But history for all of us unfolds every day. And I learned, I had my racial education just like the people of my generation. We got our racial education on the playground, at the soccer field, at the dinner table. That's where it happened for us. And the history of integration in this country really is the history of childhood. So, for example, the picture you talk about was taken the picture on the cover of the book is the picture that was taken on the day that I took my second grade picture. And on that day, after my mom had spent hours doing my hair, three white boys in my class who had been bothering me decided that that was the day that we were going to have a fight. So, that's kind of how it happened, and I won't spoil what happens. I'm okay now. The boys are probably okay now, but they weren't that day. And, that's where it happened for me. That's what unfolded.
Jennifer, who were you fighting for? Were you fighting for you, or were you fighting for your parents' decision, or were you fighting for all of Black America?
You know, I didn't really have a concept of what all of Black America was at 7 years old, but I did know that I was fighting for myself and for my parents. And what I came to discover later was I was fighting for all of those relatives of mine and all those family members whom segregation had prevented from living in places like this beautiful seaside suburb where I was growing up.
You know, it strikes me that sometimes the little things are the ones, or things that are little to other people may be large in our life. And you mention your hair in the context of this great fight scene and story. And I say great in the sense of, you know, great battle scene in a movie. It's not pretty. But you also talk about your hair. My hair grew out of my head, but it did not belong to me. Black girls did never wash our own hair. Our mothers did. Choose my own hairstyle, never. With Mickey O, as I like to call her, as the first lady, a lot of people are just catching up on the black train, on the hair train. What did you learn as a kid?
Well, you know, I learned that hair told a very powerful and important story about not just me, but my whole family. And my white friends carried brushes and combs to school. And if you're an African-American girl, if you're a woman of African descent, you know, when you were a girl, you didn't carry a brush or comb to school. Your parents thought of a hair brush or comb as a weapon. And so this is one of the ways in which I figured out early on how different I was. It was a way that I experienced my own isolation. Another similar kind of example is the makeup counter. Going to get a beauty makeover with a girlfriend of mine. She was white. And there was no makeup at the counter for me. It's the small ways, you're absolutely right, Farai, that you learn about whether or not you fit in or you don't and how that works.
Well, this idea that history is experienced by kids, you know, I'm reminded of going to a 90% black junior high in Syracuse, New York, and being the only white kid in my class. Because I was taller than all the other white kids in the school, I kept getting into fights because people would come up to me and say, how come you're so tall?
Exactly.
And on the playground, I have to defend this, and it was so much like living the history that you'd see in the papers every day.
You know, and that's exactly right. And here's the thing. Integration, the history of integration, which we don't talk about in this country very much, isn't just the history of black people. It's the history of white people, too. It is the history of kids, because it was in schools that so much of this unfolded for all of us.
Now, I suspect if I say page 168, you may know what I'm talking about here. Your father said something to you. When you guys, I believe, were on a cruise.
Yes.
And he said something. I want you to give us the context for what he said here.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah, the quote is, I'm telling you right now, your father said, and he was angry for something that had happened. I'm not raising you two for some white man.
Yes.
What was going on there? We got about 2 minutes. I don't want to miss this story,
okay.
But I want to let you rip on it.
So here we go. We are on this cruise. I'm in seventh grade. I'm about 12 years old. Everything looks great. I think that this is going to be my love boat moment. The cruise looks very much like our community. It's overwhelmingly white. And one morning after we wake up, my sister and I go to breakfast, and my dad says to us when we get back to the cabin, you've been talking to all the white kids on the ship, but you don't know anything about the black ones. And my parents completely freaked out. They said, you have to learn the names of all the black kids on this ship by the end of the day, or you don't get your cabin keys back. They kicked us out, and as we were leaving, my dad said, I'm not raising you for a white man.
Wow.
You know, this is another one of those places, dating and friendship, where we learned about what being black was actually going to mean, not just to white people, but to ourselves.
Now, I was trying to explain to someone the other day how there's the whole stereotype of the black single mother, but there's also this path that a lot of black career women get on where no one is good enough. Working class black men aren't good enough. White guys aren't good enough, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think that your book could help inform the next generation of black womanhood?
Well, you know, part of the thing that I say in this book is every woman's life begins in girlhood. And so many of these defining experiences happen to us when we have the least control over our lives. So part of the thing is for us as women to tell the story so that the next generation of women don't walk into a void of silence.
Well, the black girl next door, be sure to invite her into your home. That's the title of the book written by Jennifer Bazile, who joined us from New Haven, Connecticut. It's an extraordinary memoir of growing up as the one black child in a neighborhood of whites in upper middle class California. Jennifer, thanks so much and congratulations.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The geniuses on Wall Street are rallying again. Wall Street's open. The rally seems to be continuing. All this week, we've been talking about the American dream.
Everyone is a genius at something. The American dream is to be able to make a living with what you are a genius at, and at the same time, have what you're doing also be good for the world.
American genius, American dream. If you've done anything entrepreneurial or want to start something up that could be the next big thing, we want to hear about it. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And from the perspective of a CEO, the American dream, right after news from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. It's coming up to 27 minutes to the top of the hour. The economy continues to top the president's agenda. Today he will hear how the stimulus package is working from the head of the Economic Recovery Advisory Board, Paul Volcker. And yesterday the president met with states about their plans to spend economic stimulus dollars. The NAACP is taking aim at subprime lenders. Today it's adding Wells Fargo and HSBC to the list of targets for legal action. They accuse the banks of forcing black homebuyers into risky subprime mortgages. And the financial crisis got the comedy treatment last night when CNBC's Jim Cramer, who hosts Mad Money, turned up on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. Stewart called CNBC on the quality of its financial advice and suggested some new slogans for Cramer's show.
Cramer, he's right sometimes. Or he's like a dartboard that talks. Or you feel lucky, punk?
So Jim Cramer defended some of his network's bad calls, saying, we've got 17 hours of live TV a day to do. And Stewart shot back, maybe you could cut down on some of the wrong calls.
Yikes. Nice. All right. Sharp knives. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
And life today in general comes without a lot of guarantees or reassurances, but hey, they're not all gone.
Buy any new Hyundai, and if in the next year you lose your income, we'll let you return it. That's the Hyundai Assurance. We're all in this together, and we'll all get through it together.
I wonder if that's true if you get chocolate on the seats, as I did with this one rental car, but I'm getting too far ahead of myself. We've got a consumer-driven economy. We need people to go to the mall to stimulate the economy. On the other hand, you can't fault people for holding tight to their money, but two companies, JetBlue and Hyundai, have come up with some interesting incentives, like you buy our product now, and if something happens, if you lose your job, we guarantee we'll give you your money back. That's what it looks like on paper, at least. We're going to find out more about the deals. And joining us, we are privileged to have two major American CEOs. John Krafcek is CEO of Hyundai North America Motors, and Dave Barger is the CEO of JetBlue Airlines. And John, let me start with you. You at the Chicago Auto Show in February, you called for a revolution in the way that auto companies do business. Is this offer part of that revolution?
In a way, it is, Farai. I think the thing that this sprang from was the observation that traditional incentives that we typically use in the auto industry to help us sell cars in the fourth quarter of last year, they just weren't working. And we went out and talked to consumers, and they told us, hey, don't you guys get it? We're afraid we're going to lose our jobs. We said back to them, but, you know, most of you aren't. But they said, well, you know, I know a friend, I know a neighbor, someone down the street. We realized we needed to come up with another solution, and we really liked this idea because it's private enterprise working together as it should work.
But how much risk are you taking, and how much of a financial hit do you think you're going to take? Because, you know, if I go into the showroom and someone has melted chocolate on the backseat of the car, I don't want to get that car. What are you doing with these cars?
Well, the thing is, you have to qualify for a loan to actually qualify for the program. So we're getting good customers, and the fact of the matter is, although we talk a lot about the unemployment rate in our country, the employment rate is, you know, remarkably high, right at 92% or whatever. So the reality is most consumers are going to get through this. We're all going to get through this together. And this was a simple way for us to work with the consumer and with a third-party program supplier, a little company called EFG, which is providing this program for us. And it works. This benefits EFG, it benefits Hyundai, and most importantly, it benefits the car buyer.
So, Dave, from JetBlue here in the studio, thanks so much for coming in. What has JetBlue done? Along the lines of what John has talked about here. And as a CEO, how hard is it to keep from living in a bubble at a time when consumers are, as John has pointed out, having so many fears about actually buying your product?
Pleasure to be in the studio, John, with the takeaway. So thank you for the invitation. I think that, first of all, your second question, it's important to be in touch with the traveling public. And we carry 60,000 customers a day, and we have a staff of 11,000-plus crew members. And so I think listening and being on the front line and being in touch with your product is very, very important. I think from our perspective, the JetBlue promise is very much in alignment with the DNA of our company. This is an airline with a passenger bill of rights, the only airline in the United States with that. And my hat is tipped to John and Hyundai We followed what they were doing, a small carrier in the UK, FlyBE, doing the same, just being in touch with their customers. And we think the JetBlue Promise program is very much in alignment with, let's stimulate the economy. Let's be the right travel partner.
Oh, come on, you guys. I mean, you know, it's all about your shareholders. Come on, give me a break. This is the nice sales line, but I'm not buying any of it. Dave, John?
Yeah, I'll take the bait on that one, John. It's a I think you know, again, with the JetBlue Promise, it's not that we've had an awful lot of customers really utilize this so far. It's good through June of this year, but it's being relevant. We can't predict the future, but we can certainly try and take maybe some of the unknown out of the future, and that's what our Promise program is all about.
What is the small type? I'm going to ask each of you just very quickly, under what circumstances might I think that I could get this kind of a refund and not? Dave, let me start with you.
Sure. Small type is booking between actually started February 1st through June 1st. You involuntarily lose your job, full-time employment, 14 days prior to travel. We need a fax. We need a certified letter. By the way, the fax is so we can put the seat back into inventory, and you're eligible for a free refund. And that's up to 9 customers on your reservation.
Okay, got it. John, what's your small type?
Pretty similar, and we're proud of the program from the point of view that there really isn't a whole lot of small type. You have to have made at least 2 payments on your loan. But if you involuntarily lose your job, we've also got stipulations where if you're transferred to an international position, you keep your job, but they move you to Mexico or Europe, you also qualify.
Wow. So all right. So Jim, in the control room, all right, I want to fire me. I'll book the trip today. Okay, and then you fire me tomorrow. Okay, and then I get a free trip. Okay, are most consumers like that, Dave and John?
From our point of view, very few, tell you the truth. I mean, we end up with more refunds right after a snow event or some type of thunderstorm event than we do with this type of product.
John, I'll give you the last word.
You know, I think the key point is, and we use this message in our ads, but we're all in this together, and we're going to get through it together. I think if more companies could take initiatives like this one, I think we could find our way toward improving the economy.
Oh, that's great. John Krafcik, CEO of Hyundai North America. Dave Barger, CEO of JetBlue. Thanks, guys.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and from deep in space, the disturbing transmission.
Houston, we have a problem.
Well, it's not Houston, and maybe the statement was in Russian, but the 3 men, one small space and one chunk of debris the size of a grapefruit. It sounds a bit like the movie Apollo 13. But in fact, what happened in space yesterday was about 3 astronauts on board the International Space Station who had to evacuate to a Russian spacecraft, the Soyuz capsule, because of the potential for a collision with space junk. Ben Baisley-Walker, legal and policy consultant at the Secure World Foundation, joins us. Ben, what happened yesterday, and how likely is this sort of thing to happen around the space station?
Good morning, John. Yesterday the space station had a very conjunction potentially, which is an analysis of whether something might hit the space station with a small piece of a launch equipment from a GPS satellite. Now, that piece was actually a small weight, which was about 2 centimeters in diameter, attached to a 1-meter-long cable. So the question was is that whether or not this was actually going to hit the ISS itself.
And the piece of junk was in orbit, right?
The piece of junk was in orbit, yes.
Which means it was traveling at least at 25,000 miles per hour.
It's about 3.7 miles per second.
Wow. So
6.7 miles per second.
You get hit by something like that, and it makes a big exit wound, right?
Indeed. Yep. The example I always give is that if you have a 1-centimeter ball bearing traveling in low Earth orbit, so at 6.7 kilometers per second, it's going to go through about 2 or 3 inches of solid metal. So a very small thing can do a very large amount of damage on a satellite or on something like the ISS.
Well, what does it mean for the crew of the space station to evacuate? How much warning do they get, and how hard is it to cram themselves into the Soyuz capsule?
The Soyuz capsule has been designed as the escape mechanism for the ISS. So in this particular case, there was a red threshold late notice conjunction threat, which means that this is saying that there's a potential imminent danger of the space station being hit, which was released on Wednesday evening. So normally, the way that these things are normally tracked, the U.S. Air Force tracks about 18,000 pieces of debris and operational satellites in orbit, both at low Earth orbit and at the higher altitudes. Now, in the higher altitudes, we can track things that are larger than 1 meter, and in the lower altitudes, we can track things that are larger than 10 centimeters. So if you think back to that ball bearing, John, right. you can potentially have major problems.
Well, you know, I guess, Sadie, we think of space as like, there's aliens attacking us, but in fact, it's just junk. I have an image of, kind of like a fire drill in Midtown Manhattan where they make us all leave the building and then people stand around outside smoking cigarettes waiting for the all clear. I mean, it wasn't really like that up in space, right?
No, not exactly. Not exactly. And while the ISS and it getting hit by that is a major threat, the other concerns are, as we've seen recently with the crash between the Iridium satellite and the Cosmos satellite a few weeks ago, is that this can be a real problem to many other aspects of our operations in space. And it's not only involved in our human activities. Now, if, for example, with the Iridium satellite, many satellites had been hit, you're talking about a loss of services such as being able to pay for gas at the gas station with your credit card, getting lost with your GPS.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know about you, John, but I certainly don't know how to use a map anymore.
Exactly. You're right. I've lost that skill myself. Well, Ben Baisley-Walker, what we need is a space dozer to clear all of the junk. He's legal and policy consultant at the Secure World Foundation in Washington, D.C. A near collision at the space station yesterday. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. All this week we've been slicing and dicing the American dream.
I worked for about 25 years as an artist, didn't make any money, so I started a business that limped along, didn't do too well, but it morphed into something that I'm doing now. And it seems to me to live in a country that has that many opportunities that gives someone a chance is pretty terrific, kind of a dream.
What's your story of startup or starting out? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, a Washington power couple opens their hearts for us. But now Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Important new economic numbers came out this morning. The latest report shows that the U.S. trade deficit hits its lowest level in 6 years. And that's the difference between imports and exports. And it's down because Americans just aren't buying as much as they used to. So import demand is dropping. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and other global financial leaders are in the United Kingdom this weekend for a G20 meeting. The meeting comes ahead of a larger April summit that President Obama will attend. So one topic on their table this weekend is tax invasion. The global aid
tax
group...
Tax invasion?
Evasion. Global aid... Can you be quiet for even 30 seconds? Is that possible? So tax evasion. Global aid group Oxfam says that offshore accounts cost developing countries some $120 billion a year, and they want the West to shut down tax havens so people in poor countries don't cheat local governments out of tax money. John, it's all yours.
Oh, no, it's actually all mine. I take the bossy stick. I have it. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
We're talking here about dreams, including whether dreams include a second life. Think about Microsoft founder Bill Gates now pushing to end malaria.
Right.
Jimmy Carter, Bono. Add to that list former Secretary of Defense William S. Cohen and his wife Janet Langhart Cohen. They married on Valentine's Day in 96. She's a Democrat. He's a Republican. She's black. He's white. They wrote a book, Love in Black and White, and now they are up to big things, seeking to transform race in America. Secretary and Mrs. Cohen, thank you for coming on The Takeaway.
Good morning, Farah.
Good morning.
Pleasure to be with you.
I'm really delighted that you came on. You're hosting the second annual conference on race and reconciliation in America on Monday. What is the focus? Let's start with the specifics. And Mrs. Cohen, what's the focus of this annual conference, this second one?
Well, it's entitled Race and Reconciliation in America because that is the name of our nonprofit. And the acronym for that is RARIA.org. And I wanted to say that because when you have the word race in the title of something, it automatically sends you to the subject of either race or racism. And this focus is about health and wellness. The health and wellness of all Americans, and ultimately being America, will get to the subject of the disparities of people's health based on their race, based on their class, and based on their locale.
Now, Secretary Cohen, you obviously are someone who has reached a certain pinnacle in politics. You were a Republican appointee in a Democratic administration, the Clinton administration. It's no small job to be Secretary of Defense. But why did you decide that this was what you needed to do as part of the next mountaintop that you wanted to climb to really deal with race and reconciliation?
Because the country's in crisis. We have an epidemic. It's called obesity. And obesity is leading to enormous complications from a national security point of view. We have a very unhealthy population today that is prone to diabetes, to heart failure, to all sorts of maladies. And it's affecting the condition of obesity. It's affecting our young people coming into the military who, frankly, are not qualified or fit to serve in the military when they arrive, and is presenting quite a challenge to our recruiters and those who take on the young men and women who are willing to serve us to get them in shape to be able to defend our country. So that's one aspect of it. But I used to serve as chairman of the Aging Committee in the United States Senate, and the question of health and wellness has been something on my mind for a long, long time. And so we've got a great program with some leading individuals, Dr. Michael Roizen, who is the chairman of the Wellness Center in Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Dean Ornish, who is the founder of preventive medicine research, Deepak Chopra, that many people know. And we go on to discuss the economics and the obstacles to wellness. Why aren't we better prepared? Why aren't we staying in shape? What is causing us to be so obese? And with all of the health problems that we are funneling into our healthcare system, it doesn't matter whether it's a Hillary Clinton healthcare plan or Barack Obama healthcare plan, we can't afford it given what we're putting into it. So we've got to take better care of ourselves.
Yeah, it's really come up a lot with the stress of job losses. But John? Mm-hmm.
Well, to both of you, I mean, and that was a perfectly articulate statement of sort of the policy challenges in this very, very big problem of dealing with healthcare and the disparities in the United States. But how is the diversity in your family give you insights into what families and people are going through in the United States, you know, as related to your own personal challenges?
Well, I can speak to diversity, and I don't know, John, if you mean diversity in terms of race or age and or generation or health issues, but...
I think by getting married on Valentine's Day, right before you were sworn in, right before you were sworn in as Secretary of Defense, you are embarking on two very different challenges. One, to run the Pentagon, the Secretary Cohen, but also to exist in Washington as a very high-profile biracial couple, certainly in a city that understands that sort of thing, but nevertheless, you're public people.
You're not suggesting that being married to Janet is stressful.
Well, that's debatable, but I'll tell you, you mentioned living here in Washington, D.C., and this place is unique, it's special, and the people that come here and participate in our government, even in our academia, this is a very college-oriented city, as you all know, are a little more sophisticated on the subject of race and diversity than perhaps each of our hometowns. I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana, which is somewhat progressive now, I guess, since it voted for Obama. And Bill is from Bangor, Maine, which
is
part of northern Appalachia.
Yeah, a very small black population.
Well, you know, one thing that you have said, Janet, Mrs. Cohen, is that sometimes people make assumptions about the motivations of black people, that if you marry someone white, you must want to be white yourself.
Oh.
And I think that that may be changing a little bit, but have you ever felt sort of the icy breath of judgment on the back of your neck?
Oh, I see. I have seen that, Farah. You just hit the nail on the head. I've seen that my whole life. In growing up in a very poor environment in the 50s, wanting to be educated, wanting to speak well, wanting to dream higher than where your station was then, you were accused of wanting to be white. I wanted to be all that I am. I wanted to be successful. And, of course, you add marrying someone outside of the race, particularly someone white, you really do want to be white. And I haven't passed, but I've crossed over. And there are judgments on both sides. I think not all, but some whites assume that because I've married Bill, I'm dissatisfied and self-loathing with my own race, and I want to be his race. And, you know, they say when you get married, you become one. Which one do you become? Well, I've remained me, and I still self-identify as an African-American woman, a race woman. And on the other hand, many blacks have shunned me. One magazine that will go unnamed, and I think you've written for one of them, Farai, when my publicist called to do a story, have this magazine do a story on Bill and me because of our book, Love in Black and White, the editor said, no, we don't want to do a story on her with her white husband. And that hurt me. And, yeah, it really did, because if they knew Bill's story, my white husband's story, they would know that when he was in the U.S. Senate, he stood on the Senate floor and stood up for affirmative action.
Well, we have to end it there. Mrs. Cohen, Secretary Cohen, this has been a really interesting conversation. Your American dream includes transforming race. We were speaking with former Secretary of Defense William Cohen and his wife, Mrs. Janet Langhart Cohen, about their upcoming conference next week on race, reconciliation, and health.
What a journey this hour. We've been talking about the American dream. Earlier, we spoke with co-founder of a company called InventRight, who also launched Teddy Ruxpin.
Listening to InventRight and actually happy that the control room loved Teddy Ruxpin because we just developed a product called Smarty Bear. Smart E, like Edgar, an electronic bear, just like the Teddy Ruxpin.
My name is Teddy Ruxpin. Can you and I be friends?
Sure. And here's another inventor.
And my American dream is to have every other American wake up and have a cup of coffee they bought at organiccoffee.com. It's a little coffee company I just started that gives the majority of its profits away, not as some sort of nonprofit, but as a new kind of capitalism.
Great stuff.
And that's why
yeah.
their phone lines are so bad, because
yes,
they're
indeed.
Giving it
away. I'm surprised everybody wasn't advertising their websites all week long. If you missed anything, we're always on Take Our Podcast to Go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Farai Chidea.
Have a great weekend, and remember, there's still more of this Friday the 13th. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Sold separately from WAMO.